Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice radio show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice. The mission of the Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal economic opportunity and justice for all without truth decay. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing both creative artists and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Welcome to the Reasonable Voices Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice. And my guest today is a longtime friend and an excellent artist, Bob Chapel, the producing artistic director of the Heritage Theater Festival at Charlottesville, Virginia, at the University of Virginia. Of course, now everyone calls it HTF. Bob, good afternoon. How are you?
Fine, Marcello.
It's so good.
Nice to be here.
Oh, yes, man. It's good to hear your voice and talk to you. It's been a while. I think, ages since you've been on the show, and I think we last saw each other about a year ago at the Vet or something. Let's jump right in to the 2015 summer season. Spamalot has been driving everyone just hilariously crazy based on Monty Python and so forth. But tell us, give us some of the background, the history of the Heritage Theater Festival. After all, how many years has it been you've been there?
This is our 41st anniversary.
Yes.
And I've been with the theater since 1987. This is my 29th summer with the theater, and my 21st as producing artistic director.
Thanks.
Just basically, the festival started in 1974, a number of years before I arrived, and it was started by David Weiss, who was then chair of the drama department, and it was right when the Culberth and Helms theaters were built, and they wanted to have a summer theater festival, and they first of all decided that what they wanted to do was do American classics, and hence the name Heritage Theater, and the America's Heritage. So they started out doing a number of classics for a few years, and then as George Black once kind of joked to me, who he became the artistic director, and he kind of joked to me once where he said, we kind of ran out of American classics. So it evolved into doing a number of different kinds of plays. They did some Shakespeare. They did some new plays. They also kept doing American classics.
Mm-hmm.
When I joined the theater, they had done apparently one musical way back when, I guess in the third season, that it was not a well-known musical. I can't even remember the name of it. But but they had done one musical. But when I joined the theater, my love has not only been doing plays, which I truly love doing, but also doing musicals. So when I joined the theater in I officially joined the Department of Drama in 1990, but I had been directing. I've been coming down in the summers from New York and then San Diego to direct for Heritage in 87, 88, and 89. But then I was hired to be chair of the department and a professor in the department, and I then became managing director of Heritage. And we started doing more musicals then, and then once I became producing artistic director, we started leading off with a musical every year, a big well-known musical. So anyway, that's how the whole thing has evolved over the past 41 summers.
Wow. It's quite impressive, and
it, you know, having been a part of, I think, three seasons, I've seen how it works. It's not that you direct every show, but you direct at least two in a season, don't you?
I do.
Yeah.
One summer I directed three. I thought I was going to die.
Yes.
I usually direct two, yeah.
Yes. And it's quite a...
Rotating rep.
Thank you. Rotating rep. Thanks
and
for
actually
saying.
Actually, we used to truly do rotating rep. Uh-huh. I mean, there was a time at the beginning when they would open a play and for about four or five performances and close it for a while and then open the next play and then open the next play and then mm-hmm. open the next play. And then the last 2 weeks, you'd come back and have a different play every night. We don't do that so much anymore because mm-hmm. we now have three theaters.
Yes.
And so we don't really need to do that. So what we are doing is having three plays. These last three that are, as we're heading toward the end of the season and at the end of July, the next three shows will open. One, I think, opens on the 21st of July. That's mm-hmm. I Love a Piano. And I think Almost Maine opens on the 23rd.
Uh-huh.
And then I think my show, Violet, opens on the 28th or something
yes,
like that.
Certainly.
And so people will be able to, the last week, they'll be able to see all three shows if they choose to,
mm-hmm.
or they can see in the last 2 weeks, they can see all three shows. So it's kind of like rotating rep, but it's not quite rotating rep anymore.
Yeah.
And so, we've gone through, the name of the theater has evolved. It first really was called the Heritage Theater Festival, and then they changed it to the Heritage Repertory Theater, which was meant that we were doing rolling rep,
yes.
or rotating rep. And then once, a few years ago, I can't remember how many years ago, but not too long ago, we sat down and said, you know, this is more of a festival now than it is rotating rep.
Mm-hmm.
So we changed it back to the original Heritage Theater Festival.
Fantastic. And now, do you like the fact that people refer to it as HTF?
Oh, sure.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Well, we used to call it HRT.
Okay.
It's not a problem at all. I think that's great.
Yes. Well, about the shows, there are three shows left this season, Almost Maine, Violet, and I Love a Piano. But can we
yep.
talk a bit about Love before we get into what's coming?
Sure. Love opened the season, and it was one of those, it's one of those quirky plays. It was written, I think, in 1964, something in the early 60s,
mm-hmm.
by a man by the name of Murray Schlichel.
Yes.
And it was directed originally by Mike Nichols.
Yes.
On Broadway. It starred Alan Arkin, Eli Wallach, and Ann Jackson.
What a cast.
And it was nominated for a Tony Award for Best Play.
Mm.
It ran over 900 performances.
Mm.
When I was the production coordinator and stage manager at the North Shore Music Theater in Beverly, Massachusetts, which was a bus and truck, we would bring in a bus and truck show every week.
Yes.
So all of a sudden, the producer brought in this little quirky play called Love, and with it came Joanne Worley of Laugh-In fame.
Oh yes.
And I had always remembered how quirky and wonderful and funny the play was, with just three people,
mm-hmm.
three characters, and so I'd always kind of kept going back and looking at it, and this year just presented itself as kind of the right thing for the Kaplan. So we opened Love, and the people that came to see it really did enjoy it, and I have had a number of people come up to me and tell me how much they liked it. And then the following week we opened Spamalot, and
yes.
Spamalot turned out to be one of the biggest hits we've ever had. We sold out every performance.
Wow.
And, which is pretty, because it was in the Culbert, it's in our largest theater, so it was pretty great.
Yes.
We laughed our way through every rehearsal. It was great fun to do. I had a stellar cast of great comic actors, and it was really a great fun, and I was very happy to have done Spamalot. I'd been thinking about that for a long time.
Yes.
And had always thought, oh, it's way too big for us to do. And it was too big for us to do.
But you did it anyway.
But we did it anyway. So.
Well, you know, I've heard, I knew from you that you'd been thinking about spam a lot for a while, but also there were others in Charlottesville, including our mutual friend Bree Warner at the, what is it, the Charlottesville Albemarle Convention Visitors Bureau. She was on the show not too terribly long ago. And was so excited because you were finally doing Spam-a-Lot, and she said she'd been begging you for years. But I know, you know, as I've always said to you, Bob, you have an amazing sense of timing and casting. I think two of the many important things about being a director and that being an artistic director and being a producing artistic director. So you, I know you have in your head as well as your computer this this army of talent, both behind the scenes and the actors, and you seem to always keep in touch that vision. So as you are also at the same time considering, as you said, you remember Love, you've been thinking about Spam-a-Lot for ages, and then something comes together for you and you say, okay, this is, now's the time. I know that's a lot to kind of capsulize, but how do you, because I've asked you this off the air, how do you do that? I mean,
I don't know. well, I mean, one thing I try to do is I've been always trying to do, at least for me personally, to not repeat a show. I like to keep doing shows that Heritage has not done
Excellent.
Before, and especially me doing shows that I've not directed before.
Yes.
So that's part of it right there. The other part is I have been really fortunate over the years to have worked with some just wonderful, including yourself,
Thank you.
With some wonderful, wonderful actors, and I do keep their names in a computer and in my computer, and I think I probably have, 800 to 1,000 names.
Wow.
in my computer now, and so in addition to auditions that I have locally, and sometimes I go to Memphis to the Unified Professional Theater Auditions, the UPTAs,
mm-hmm.
Where I see a lot of people in a weekend. But I pretty much all of a sudden say, gee, this role is really perfect for, let's use Jonathan Corsi, who's back again this summer. This role is perfect for him. Or Emily Thompson and I have been talking about doing Violet for a couple of years, and this is the year. And I have always wanted, for instance, that the second musical needs usually to be smaller, and it needs to be a little bit more serious most of the time. And so Violet, for instance, is that. It's only got 11 actors in it, it is a little bit more serious in nature. So was Next to Normal.
Mm-hmm.
So was Sunday in the Park with George. So was Light in the Piazza.
Yes.
And so it kind of creates a nice balance against a Spam-a-Lot or an Annie Get Your Gun.
Sure.
Or
even My Fair Lady.
My Fair Lady.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I don't, you know, to answer your question, I don't know that I have anything special in regards to the choice of shows or the choice of actors, except that I think I constantly think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that lends itself to usually making some good choices. And I also run by, you know, choices of shows. Before I totally decide,
mm-hmm.
I run it by a lot of people.
Uh-huh.
I just, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? Because
yes.
Sometimes you get caught up in what you want to do and not really see the forest from the trees in
no.
that regard.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've had that kind of conversation with you too, but I'm just... I've just always been impressed with the casting, and with, as you say, I've been very aware that obviously you choose to do something new every summer, and that, considering the amount of time you've been there, that in itself is a challenge, but it's a wonderful thing, and the results are wonderful. I do want to get to the last three shows of the season. We want to talk about those and talking about other decisions you've made, career paths and all that sort of thing, but I just want to mention that I do remember now, the last time you were on the show, we talked about Next to Normal. And since you've mentioned it, I just want to bring up again just how impressive and tight and realistic and hungry and angry and full of passion and realism, as you know, I know, from life with my parents, etc. But Next to Normal was a powerful and, I think, risky thing to try, and yet it was magnificent. And now,
thank you,
to bring Violet, and as you say, it's in that same vein of being a musical, but musicals don't have to be just one thing. We don't even call them musical comedies anymore. We call them musicals.
That's exactly right, yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, once West Side Story changed all that.
Yes.
Actually, you know what actually changed it? I think actually was Oklahoma, even before West Side Story, is they started calling it the musical and not the musical comedy, yeah.
Well, that was serious.
Somebody dies at the end of Oklahoma.
Exactly.
That was an unusual thing that happens in a musical. So, yeah, well, Next to Normal was a special thing, and Violet, but since you brought it up, mm-hmm. I mean, it's a story of this young girl who has been scarred at age 13 by accident by her father wielding an axe and across her face, and she's now 25, and she all of a sudden believes that she can go to this evangelist in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and that he's going to rid her of the scar. And so it's quite a powerful piece. The music is by Janine Tesori, who she's one of the most eclectic composers in the musical theater today.
Yes.
I mean, she wrote Thoroughly Modern Millie, and she wrote Shrek the musical.
Yeah.
But then she also just won the Tony Award for writing Fun Home,
which was
about a young woman and her father both coming out of the closet and admitting to their homosexuality. And so it was a whole different kind of thing. And she wrote a musical called Caroline or Change, which was also different, very different music. So she's an amazing, and this music is country western blues, and it's really great music. And the story is very compelling.
Yes.
And it's also set in 1964, just after the civil rights movement began, and Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act.
Yes.
And it's also just as the Vietnam War is beginning. So there it deals with racial relations, it deals with the impending problems with Vietnam.
Yes.
And it also deals with, you know, the televangelists the healers.
Yes.
Yes. You know, so it's a wonderful show. Yeah.
And as you say, she's so eclectic. I mean, an amazing range for a composer in styles and in storyline, for heaven's sake. I mean, it's quite impressive, and I'm looking forward to seeing Violet. I really am.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Maybe we will take a short break. Now seems to be a good time, because I do want to jump into Almost Maine and I Love a Piano and decisions you're making and have made and all that. And so why don't we take a break now? Everybody stay with us. Remember, I am chatting with the producing artistic director, Bob Chapel, of the Heritage Theater Festival, also known as HTF, at the University of Virginia. He's been there. The festival has been there for 41 years, and he is directing in his 29th season there. Quite an impressive record. Everything always new and bright and challenging and breaking boundaries. But we'll be back for more with Bob. Stay with us.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Money is a powerful motivator. Ask anyone what he or she would do for $1 million, and you'll likely hear anything. But when we give in to the temptation of money, there are consequences to be paid. The darkly comic fable, Cheap Thrills, an award-winning first feature from director E.L. Katz, explores the corrupting power of easy money. Craig is a family man who loses his job and gets an eviction notice on the same day. Drowning his sorrows at a bar with his old friend Vince, they chance to meet a couple seeking some birthday fun. Soon, they are putting their money to use with increasingly demented challenges. As the night goes on, the dares escalate and the price goes up, begging the question, is there really any winner? It's hard to watch cheap thrills and not be on the edge of your seat. The film feels rocket-propelled, driven by snappy dialogue and thrilling action. The jokes are unforced, and the ensemble performance is particularly noteworthy. But be forewarned. As the night drags on for our heroes, some of the dares become, shall we say, a bit stomach-churning? Cheap thrills. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Find us on the web at IndieFilmMinute.com.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices radio show with my guest, Bob Chapel, who is the producing artistic director of the Heritage Theater Festival in Charlottesville, Virginia, at the University of Virginia, and has been so for 29 years, almost three decades. Speaking of the number of three, we have three more shows this season, Almost Maine, Violet, and I Love a Piano. What's this mystical and whimsical Almost Maine? I love that. Almost, comma, Maine.
Comma, Maine. Yes. Yeah, one thing I should clarify, I haven't actually been producing artistic director for 29 years.
Okay.
But I've been with the theater for 29 years, and I've been producing artistic director for 21. So I don't want to take credit where credit isn't due.
Okay.
So in any case, Almost Maine. Almost Maine is a play that has been around for the last number of years, several years. You know, it's one of those plays that has played in every regional theater that you can imagine in the country, around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another one of these plays that we were talking about that I had read several years ago and thought it was just a lovely, lovely play. And it just hadn't been the right time for some reason. And this year, I felt that it was. I'll actually read, which is on the back of the cover of the script.
Okay.
From, Dramatis Play Service. On a cold, clear, moonless night in the middle of winter, all is not quite what it seems in the remote, mythical town of Almost, comma, Maine.
Mm.
And Almost Maine, by that it means it's so far north, it's almost in Canada. It's almost out of here.
Mm-hmm.
As the northern lights hover in the star-filled sky above, Almost's residents find themselves falling in and out of love in unexpected and often hilarious ways.
Mm.
Knees are bruised, hearts are broken, but the bruises heal and the hearts mend almost in this delightful midwinter night's dream. And what the play is it's a series of vignettes that are played by a number of characters played by four actors.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a great deal of doubling that goes on in the show. We have four wonderful actors in the show, and so it's really a delightful kind of conglomeration of little mini dramas.
Wow.
And all dealing with love and love found and love lost, and there's a certain amount of magic and mystery to to some of the pieces. John Cariani is the writer. He's currently in Something Rotten. He plays the second lead. I think he plays Shakespeare. That's currently on Broadway. So
yes.
He's an actor and a playwright. But this has been a very, very successful play for him, as I said, has played all around the country.
And it's going to be in the Ruth Kaplan Theater, right?
It's going to be in there. That's right. It's going to be in Ruth Kaplan Theater, and I think, as we said, it opens on the 23rd.
Yes.
Is that right? It does.
That's right.
Yeah, on the 23rd of July.
And I think closes August 1st.
And closes on all three shows: Violet, I Love a Piano, and Almost Maine. All close on the 1st of August.
Okay, so that gives us a time frame. Get your tickets. Don't waste time. Okay.
Right.
Almost Maine is, you know, I read that too, what you read to us, and I thought, wow, it's a kind of play you really want to see, because it's so clever, the whole concept of it. But
it is.
Tell us just briefly. I know people, I have a thing about this, you know, plaques and the names and theaters and photographs, and I always ask, tell us, who is Ruth Kaplan?
Ruth and Mortimer Kaplan. Let me start with her husband.
Okay.
Mortimer Kaplan was a drama major when he was here in the 40s.
Hmm.
And he went on to become the head of the IRS under John F. Kennedy.
Wow.
He went to law school here, as well as doing his undergraduate work here. And he founded one of the most important tax law firms in the country, Kaplan and Drysdale, which is in Washington D.C.
Yes.
Mort is actually, he just turned 99.
Wow.
And has been just an amazing supporter of the drama department and of the law school as well. He mm-hmm. gave good deal of money to the law school.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, his wife, Ruth Kaplan,
mm-hmm.
was one of the dearest, most intelligent women I have ever known.
Mm.
She passed away a couple of years ago, in her 90s.
Wow.
And she was she was a teacher, and here in the Charlottesville school system, she was a teacher. I believe mm-hmm. she was in the public schools. I'm not sure, but I know she was a teacher and so smart. I would have some of the best conversations
wow.
with her as I've ever had with anybody, discussing theater and discussing the arts, etc. In her 80s, she wrote a screenplay, and that actually got produced. Mm-hmm. The family. Her oldest son is a film producer, Lee Kaplan, out in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And he produced this film, and I can't remember the name of it all of a sudden. But in any case, it had a decent showing across the country, and was shown at our film festival as well. And so in any case, Mort really wanted to build a theater that would be not only good for theatrical productions, but that would also be good for dance, which is what Ruth really, really also loved.
Uh-huh.
And so he gave the initial substantial amount of money to get the Kaplan Theater going,
mm-hmm.
and it was agreed that he would name it after Ruth. So and she was still alive when it had been finalized. And when it was completed,
uh-huh.
We had a ceremony here that so that she was able to attend. So that's who Ruth Kaplan was. The Kaplan family have been unbelievably supportive of the university in so many ways.
Well, I'm so glad I asked that question. I knew more about her than I did her husband, but I realize now I know who her husband is.
Right, right,
wow.
Right.
All right. Thank you for that. Tell us, I know we've talked about Violet a bit, and we may come back to it, but just so we don't miss out on I Love a Piano. This, again, four singers singing Irving Berlin.
That's correct.
I love it.
Yeah, and this is a series of medleys that starts around the music he wrote around 1910 and takes it all the way through to the music he wrote in the late 1950s,
uh-huh.
or the late 40s, getting through Annie Get Your Gun.
Uh-huh.
So it has it's really an evening of Irving Berlin's greatest hits.
Fantastic.
Is really what it is. And then there are a number of songs that I, you know, in looking at the titles, I don't know all of them, but
mm-hmm.
many I do. I mean, things like A Pretty Girl Is Like a Melody,
yes.
Alexander's Ragtime Band,
yes.
Blue Skies,
mm.
I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm,
mm-hmm.
Putting on the Ritz, Let's Face the Music and Dance,
yes.
how deep is the ocean? Oh, how I hate to get up in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
White Christmas, God Bless America.
It just goes on and on, yes.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then getting into a lot of songs that he did from Annie Get Your Gun at the end. So it's a real tribute. There are four singers, and it's a series of medleys. So they kind of go from one great song to another, to another, to another, to another. And it kind of tells his life through his music.
Wow.
Tells about his life, yeah.
You know, he was so prolific, and it's all amazing. And I have some recordings of him actually singing a few of his songs, which were,
right.
which is always interesting. But he, and how the paths crossed with Cole Porter and others that we,
you know.
But back in the day when, I think it was Cole Porter who said it, but Irving agreed and laughed at the, when it only took one man to write a song. I remember that's one of them. But Irving Berlin, I mean, gee.
He was America's tunesmith.
Yes.
He wrote, he never learned how to read music. I don't know if you knew that.
I did know that. Yes.
He sat at the piano and as he would compose these things, he had a person write things down to write the music actually down and he wrote over 1,000 songs.
I wouldn't be surprised.
So it was amazing. And he lived to be, I think he lived to be 100
yes.
or 101
yeah.
or something like that.
Yes.
So he was an amazing guy. The one of my favorite stories is that Rodgers and Hammerstein came to him. They were first going to do Annie Get Your Gun.
Mm-hmm.
And then they decided not to. They said they needed to get a composer to do it. And they went to Irving Berlin and Irving Berlin said, "What are you talking about? I'm this little Jewish man from New York. I can't write this hillbilly musical." And Hammerstein says, "Just take the G's off all the ends of all the songs, above all the words.
Yes.
and as opposed to anything, etc." So anyway, so he went home and he composed 5 songs. And brought them in and played them in a weekend and played them for Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Wow.
And they said right then,
yes.
and so that's the rest is history.
Yes. Wow. Speaking of history. Yes. Tell us, I know, again, I as I said, the last time we actually saw each other, I think, was at the Vet, and you mentioned to me you were seriously thinking about this season being your last, at least in the position of producing artistic director. And since then, it's all the media has it. And I'd like to talk to you about it. I guess everyone chooses, they know it's whatever their feelings are. But what made you decide and now was the time? I mean, I've already complimented you on your timing, so I know you.
Yeah.
Do these things with a...
Well, several things. I mean, first of all, for the last couple of summers, in the midst of the heat, I don't mean literally heat outside, but the heat of producing
yes.
a summer season, the last couple of summers, in the middle of each summer, I would say, I don't know how I can keep doing this.
Mm.
So it's been coming in that regard,
yes.
in terms of... And then I realized, I didn't realize, I turned 70 this summer.
Oh.
Just turned 70.
Well, happy birthday, goodness.
Yeah, I have not spent very much time in the summers with my wife over the past 29 summers.
Yes.
So it just became the right time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to have enough time for the university to decide whether they want to keep Heritage going, which I'm assuming they're going to do,
mm-hmm.
and to then find whoever is going to take my place. And so So I know that there are those discussions are going on in terms of the future, and it just was right. And I'm going to miss it terribly. I mean, I really have loved doing this. I've been very, very lucky in my life to have found, you know, something that has been as I felt so productive every summer in doing. But I think it's time. It's always good. You know, every organization, it's good that you get a little fresh ideas, and new people are good for an organization, and I think it's just that time. So, yeah, so this is definitely my last summer as producing artistic director, and I am hoping that I'm going to continue to direct once I'm going to retire officially from the university next June 1st, and then I'm hoping that I spend the rest of my days, as long as I'm lucid and healthy, occasionally directing a show or two or three in a year, and then enjoying life. So that's my plan for retirement.
And do you plan to stay in Virginia?
Oh yeah, we're going to stay as much as we know right now. We love Charlottesville. It's been our home. We have so many good friends here, and we have no plans to leave. No, we're just going to make this our kind of our home base. And I'm going to I went last fall. I directed a play at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Had a wonderful time doing it, and I'm hoping that I'll find those venues occasionally, you know, twice a year or so, that I could go and do that, so I can keep doing that. I love being in rehearsal.
Yes.
And but I just don't want to run this thing.
I people tell me I love the rehearsal process, and I don't know if you know this or not, but I don't know if I've ever said it to you, but I've said it to others when they ask me to perform in theater. Now, I on camera, I love that, and I do that, but I will always say to people, the only person who gets me on the stage is Bob.
Well, you've been good for us.
Well, and I loved every minute of it, but I, like you, I love the rehearsal process. I love that part of it, and once it opens and you see, okay, there it is, it's all working now, it belongs to the actors, I'm ready for the next rehearsal.
Yeah, me too.
But you, with your schedule over the last 29 years, wow. So it's been decades, Bob, and you have left your artistic fingerprints, handprints, and shoulders on which to stand at an amazing place that's quite, Charlottesville, Virginia, we know its history, its culture, and we now know that a lot of the artistic quality comes from the University of Virginia, and certainly the standards for professionalism in theater in our area comes from the Heritage Theater Festival. And you, I mean, I know there were people before you, but you're the only one I've known there. And I've known you as a friend. I've known you as an actor. I've even been one of the people who asked, what do you think about doing this show? it's not enough to say hats off, you know, and I know you're not going away, and that's a good thing. But give us some parting words of wisdom. What do we do next?
What do I do next?
What do you think we should do next? Or
you mean in regards? Well, you mean in regards to Heritage?
Heritage, you know, yes.
Yeah.
Life.
Well, I just hope. I do hope. I think that it is important. One thing I tried is to keep connecting Heritage with the academic mission of the drama department, so that it's not just been a separate entity. I've always tried to. There are always a few of our very best students who are on stage, as well as local very good actors like yourself, as well as people from around the country. And I hope that formula continues, I hope that Charlottesville, you know, one of the biggest gotten enough problems or things to face, is getting young people, young audiences, to get into the theater and learn to enjoy live performance. And as the cell phone games, et cetera, become more and more prevalent, it's, I think, harder and harder to do that. So I hope that Charlottesville, when you say, what do we do next? I'm in the big we.
Yes.
I hope Charlottesville still does all it can to embrace the theater. And I hope all the organizations, not just Heritage or the Drama Department, but also the Live Arts and
yes.
Four County Players,
yes.
And just continue to thrive, and maybe even some newer theaters pop up along the way. So that's what I hope, and that's what I don't know how else to say it. I absolutely love going to the theater, and I think once people have a chance to do that and go to see some really good theater,
yes.
so that they can appreciate what really good theater is all about, that they will want to come back. And I don't think, they've been saying the theater's dying forever for the last 50 years.
Yes.
Oh, the theater's dying, but it's not. Broadway right now is taking in more money than it's ever taken in, and they charge the more money.
That helps too.
Exactly. But they still are thriving.
Yes.
And so I think people are always going to want to go and see live performance.
Yes. And that's the way to grab the children as well, I think. All right. Well, I feel like I'm saying goodbye. We're going to have some coffee or something. This is not good.
No, we'll do that.
Yes. But I just it's been a moving interview with me on so many levels, to be talking with Bob Chapel, the soon-to-be former producing artistic director after 21 years and after working 29 years at the Heritage Theater Festival and the University of Virginia. You were once also, the head of the drama school, yes?
Yeah, I was chair of the drama department for 15 years of that time,
So, it's a lot to tip your hat to and a lot to be proud of, and I'm so pleased to know you, Bob. And before I get too emotional, I'm just going to say I will be seeing you.
I'll be seeing you.
There you go.
Homie old.
You got it.
Yes. Charlie Chaplin wrote that.
Yes.
Anyway.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Bob, for being on the show. Wishing you all the best. We'll keep in touch. Bye now.
All right. Very good. Bye-bye.
Stay with us as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Particle Fever follows the steps of 6 out of the 10,000 scientists from 100 different countries working to launch the Large Hadron Collider. You remember the Collider project, don't you? It's the 17-mile-long underground ring just outside Geneva. It's designed to send subatomic protons speeding in opposite directions until they smash into each other and release still smaller origins of matter. But in Particle Fever, you don't even need to know that much to be fascinated by this search for what makes up our universe and those who live in it. Various conflicting theories, problems, and setbacks sustain the suspense as brilliantly as a well-constructed thriller. And finally, the cameras were present for what is arguably the greatest discovery of all time, when the Higgs boson, the God particle, emerged from theory to solid fact. No matter how science-challenged you are, you will remain enthralled with this film, overwhelmed by both our human insignificance and the impressive power of our little minds to search for meaning. And you will be blown away by the suggestions of what remains to be discovered about multiverses, black holes, and dark matter. Will we find answers in the coming years, or will we find that there are none? Particle Fever. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, here with my pets and pet peeves, hoping you'll join me in a wake-up cup of coffee. Beating the memory lane crowd. Now that turkeys shop before Black Friday, it's not surprising that some media personality shows are rushing into 2013 year-end memories before it's even Christmas Eve. Most of us know memories recapture us and replay in the twinkling of an eye, an aromatic breeze, a squeeze of the shoulder, or in the moment of that burned taste after a fire. Faster than a mouse-clicked link, you're back to that owl in the woods. First kiss, wedding day, first shared Christmas tree, or moment of silence. Memories take us back to rain on a tin roof, our car driving us the long way home, an uncle's cackle, fireplace crackling, an aunt's knowing smile, grandma's special homemade icing, barking dogs, parents independently slipping a few 20s into your palm, and there you are, back at the beginning of the roller coaster ride, inhaling all of a teenager's unknowns, smelling the sweets before tasting the bitter, the sound of the wind and the chilly feel of snow in our face, blowing hair backwards and propelling dreams forward. Imagine Utah, Colorado, and Virginia easing toward cuddling up to justice and equality for all, despite some being drag-queened forward, kicking and screaming in their red boots. When friends share memories with me, I remember who, what, and why I celebrate in life. Mostly it's lifelong friends, Lance and Pamela, Mercedes McCambridge, or newcomers, Boomy, Bill, Daniel, and Michelle. Chance meetings on the streets of New York City, like hailing a cab for Carol Channing. A chatty stroll with Colleen Dewhurst, James Whitmore, and Tommy Toon. A gracious nod from passing Glenn Close and Tony Randall. Quite literally running into Nathan Lane and Jack Lemmon. Jane Alexander's thank you, an answered note from Julie Harris, telephone chats with Celeste Holm, book signing with Pavarotti, supervising Juilliard students during an invited-only rehearsal of Placido Domingo's Met conducting debut, and a moment backstage at Ford's Theater with Rosalind Russell. The point is not name-dropping, or tears during Oscar night memorials, or even how much I miss Peter O'Toole, who I never met, or Mom, who I'll never forget. The point is, every moment is a memory in the making, and every one a reason for celebration, and 'tis the season every day, in every way.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of The Reasonable Voice. Website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.